Welcome, Red Ice members. We are talking with Hugh Montgomery about the God Kings of Europe, the God Kings of England, and the God Kings of Utrimer, the trilogy of books, as it were. We're kind of jumping a little bit back and forth, and that's okay. It's very interesting hearing about Hugh's research and theories. And I want to begin this segment to zoom out a little bit more and talk about the origins of many of the dynasties that we've been talking about so far. Mesopotamia, Sumer, or Babylon. Hugh, I took notice that you before, when we talked about Babylon in the first segment, said these beings. Maybe you can clarify that a little bit, because I've always wanted to know what the root of the idea of a king is, or you know, who was the first king, and why did he, or even she, if we're talking about a queen here, get to be in a position like that. What's your idea, Hugh?
I got not the vaguest idea.
Okay.
Well, I really don't know. I suspect it was simply a question of who could bash the hardest.
Really? Is that so?
And who could cut off the most heads. But that's purely my idea. I don't know.
That's not very noble, is it?
No, probably not. But I suspect that that's how it happened.
Jeez, really?
Whoever wielded the biggest club became king.
I'm
a bit sort of I'm not terribly sure that I believe in all this sort of certainly not none of this business of sort of alien inductions and all the rest of it.
Sure. No, but the reason you said these beings, right? But that was just. Yeah, I specifically, because I raised my eyebrows when you said that these beings down there, you know, it's like, I'm not saying that you meant that these were aliens or anything like that.
No.
I'm just thinking
it was simply that I was using that in the general sense that they were down there, that they were humans. They were.
Right. Yeah.
No.
but there's no... As you have no ideas, theories about, you know, how this all got started, because again, it's very difficult, it's very loose and very much on the speculative level here, I understand that, but I mean, the idea of nobility, aristocracy, and the royal bloodlines, you know, how the heck can something like that even get started? It's a puzzle to me, at least, and I just wanted to know if you have some input on it.
You see, I'm not terribly sure that this business of bloodlines. Let's do two different things. Let's talk about nobility first.
Mm-hmm.
Nobility meant really one thing and one thing only, and that is that the people were known. Nobilitas meant you were known.
Right.
In other words, you were known to the authorities, the king, whoever it was, usually because you owned land. Or because you controlled land or you controlled people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might have been the chief of a clan. So you had a lot of warriors, so it was someone that you had to take notice of. So you were a noble. Now, you may or may not have had a title. You may have just been a chief. You might have been a king. You might have been an earl. It doesn't matter. Nobility was simply someone who was known. So that's sort of one thing. As regards bloodlines, I actually think that this is a very modern idea. I don't think that prior to, I don't know, maybe the Victorian times, maybe a bit earlier than that, anyone was terribly worried about bloodlines in the sense that we use them today.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the feudal system, the king owned all the land, and he gave it out to his tenants in chief and made them an earl or a baron or whatever it might be. But if they rebelled against him or he got fed up with them, he could take it all away again. So the idea of all of this thing being inherited is quite modern. It's probably not until 13th, 14th century, really, we start getting this idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's relatively modern idea, I think. And particularly this business of bloodlines, which everyone's getting terribly worked up about, particularly sort of bloodlines from Jesus business.
Well, yes.
that's terribly modern. I mean, that's sort of in the last 20, 30 years or something, I suspect. Because quite frankly, I mean, it seems to me a bit of a silly thing. If Jesus was an ordinary human being and he married and had children, then what was the big deal about being descended from him?
Exactly. One of my questions.
If he wasn't, if he was a god, then you're not descended from him. So you can't both have your cake and eat it.
Right, right. So
I'm not sort of terribly into that. I mean, I use the words because there aren't any other words to use, but I'm sort of, to a fair amount, I think it's sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, the importance of the, you don't put any big importance on the fact, because that was one area that I did want to get into with you about, you know, if you put the connotation that Jesus was more than a man, then I can understand that there's, you know, interest in that, so to speak, that there's something different there, and what that might be can be argued about, obviously. But, so what you're saying basically is that you don't put too much of a weight behind this.
I put absolutely none in it. I mean, to me, I'm much more interested in the Odonic line, which has at least the concept of a god-king along the line.
What defines...
That's much more interesting. The coming all the way from Mesopotamia, right through into Scandinavia, then coming down into Europe, etc. That is interesting. To me, that's much more interesting than this Davidic line of Jesus business.
What defines a god-king? Are there certain properties,
well, I mean, quite
then?
Literally. I mean, you know, like the pharaohs were god-kings.
Right.
The representative of God on earth, or of a particular God on earth.
Mm.
And in the case of the pharaohs, they were, I don't know, the representative of Osiris or Isis, if they were female. In the case of the Kassites, presumably it was Marduk.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, they were the physical incarnation, if you want, on earth of the God.
And this is something that runs in a family line then as well? Or do you keep, you know, there must be something that you're keeping that on then? Because...
Look, I mean, let's just take a quick example. Supposing that I'm right, and that Jesus had these children, and that they all had descendants.
Mm.
So, how many people are going to descend from him? Probably between 1.5 and 3 million.
Very many, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so what's the big deal?
Yeah, exactly. we get back to it.
The fact that, you know, you might descend from a Kassite dynasty is interesting because that is actual, as far as I'm concerned, really historically something that, you know, and particularly if there's this CCR5 Delta 32 thing. I mean,
yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Because that is a... that has a point, if you see what I mean.
Yes, exactly. It's a property there in the genetic code or whatever. Yes.
Yeah, but the other, I just find, well, okay, so what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not as if Jesus had the best claim to the throne of Israel.
Mm.
You know, there were three other claimants
who
actually had much better claims. There was the exilarch in Baghdad, the exilarch in Western Europe, and the Nassai in Jerusalem, all of whom had much better claims to be head of the Davidic line.
Hmm. What if you are a devout Christian and your, you know, belief in this is that Jesus was a god? Then there is another obviously important aspect to that. That would obviously then that person obviously have to also believe that Jesus had children, of course, which might be a little bit of an oxymoron, if you want to put it that way, but do you think that there is some kind of I mean, I've heard this, for instance, that there is an interest in who, let's take the Pope, for instance, he's the vicar of Christ, right? He is the stand-in representative of God until the time that Jesus comes back, right?
Yep.
So could there be some kind of discussion here about who actually owns the entire planet in regards to descendants of Jesus?
No.
You know what I mean?
Somehow I don't think so.
Right, right.
No, that sort of discussion is a bit esoteric for me.
It is, yeah. But it's Kind of interesting, I think. Anyway, we can...
I'm afraid I'm a little more down to earth than that.
Absolutely, no worries.
I tend to deal in documented evidence and what you can extrapolate from it, rather than sort of highfalutin theories about, anything.
Right. And a quick note, I guess, on the bloodlines business again. You mentioned 15th, possibly 16th century that this was brought up and made. Do you think that this might even be a legal thing, maybe, that this is monetary interest, you know, keep the wealth in the family, so to speak,
that
type of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, completely. Mm. I mean, this whole business of sort of the intermarrying of the various families, it was all to do with keeping the land in the family, keeping the titles in the family, keeping the money in the family.
Mm.
That's what it was all about.
Yes.
And, you didn't marry for love, for goodness sake. You married because so-and-so brought a dowry of this, that, and the other to this one, and that meant that the bit of land which was adjacent to theirs now belonged to them, and so on.
Yes, yes. So at this point, then, we know that you don't place too much weight behind the fact of who is descendants of Jesus or not, but do you think, or do you believe, or do you have evidence for that there are descendants of this man alive today? What's your take on this?
Well, if the claim of the Elchizites to descend from Jesus is correct, and I believe it probably is, belief is probably the wrong word. There is substantial documentary evidence to suggest that,
mm-hmm.
I think I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Then, when they married into the Odonic dynasty, when Atta Ulf and Maria married, I don't even know if they did marry. I mean, she was just one of many wives or concubines he had.
Mm.
But from that descends a line, and we can trace that line. Okay?
Yeah.
So, those two lines are traceable right down to today, at least as far as documentary evidence is concerned. However, that presupposes that all the wives for the last 2,000 years haven't had a lover on the side.
Okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Because, if they weren't faithful to their husbands, then, the fact that there's documentary evidence they got married means nothing.
Right. So what houses or lines are we talking about here? Any names that we know?
House of Norman. I mean, for example, all of the royal families up in Scandinavia, with I think the exception of Sweden, because you went and got
a French
marshal in, didn't you?
Absolutely. And before that, Vasa, that was actually from Poland. So we lost the Swedish line of kings a long time ago. So
yeah, well, okay, but certainly the Danish, and from the Danish you get German and Greek. Lines, you get the line, the present line of the British monarchs and so on.
Yeah.
And certainly the line of the Valois of France, the Bourbons, etc.
Mm-hmm.
All of those lines descend either the male or female from one or other of the Umbrunga dynasties.
I see.
And indeed, there's a whole lot of others. For example, the cousins of William the Conqueror. I mean, you had Beaumont, Fitzosborne, Montgomery, and I forget what the other one was called. They all have descendants.
Mm-hmm. And many of the European houses obviously are connected as well. They are. Would you say that all?
I would have thought that all of them were interconnected one way or another.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
I mean, Rurik, for example, the founder of the Russian royal house.
Mm-hmm.
He was another.
Right. So it's
you get. Or I would have thought that almost all of the royal houses of Europe were interconnected in one way or another.
Hmm. Yeah. Which is interesting. How about the Windsors? Do they wield a special place in all of this, or the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha line, I would reckon?
Well, I mean, yeah, as you say, they're actually Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Now, yes, probably, but I haven't. I mean, certainly they go back to the Stuarts, or at least on the female side.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the Stuarts are all Hungers on both sides. So, yes. And, of course, the Habsburg Lorraines and so on.
Yes, yes, exactly. And, again, I want to maybe return a little bit to something we talked about before as well in regards to the land to the east, Otremer, or Jerusalem, as it were. Why this region is so important, either if you talk about it in the context of the Ulvungar dynasty or what have you. But again, I mean, there's fighting to this day going on. There's upheaval over this region, that there's a claim to this piece of land. Do you know why?
Oh, dear. I mean, one of the biggest problems, as far as I'm concerned, is religion. Once you get religion involved and you start saying that I have a claim to this, that, and the other because God says so, or because my holy book says so, all normal, natural, logical thinking seems to go out the window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that once you, you know, once someone says, well, you know, there is one God, his prophet Muhammad, he's decided what the law is, it's Sharia law, and you can't change it, you have a problem. Once someone says, well, according to Torah, you know, God gave this to the Jews, you have a problem. Once you have, you know, a pope getting up and saying that, you know, Jesus Christ is the only Son of God, etc., you have a problem. If we could only get rid of religion, perhaps we'd be an awful lot further forward, because then perhaps people could start talking to each other logically and sensibly instead of all this religious claptrap.
I would agree, but I think a lot of people wouldn't. And the
I'm
thing
I'm
is,
sure you're right.
And the thing is that a lot of people, they find, you know, comfort in religion. It's some kind of base in many people's lives. And it's very difficult.
Well,
I mean,
I think it was Karl Marx who said, you know, religion is the opium of the people, and to a large extent, he was right. The only trouble is that communism is just as bad.
Yeah, well, there we go. Good point. Very good point.
It's
always an ideology, or again, you're leaving your individuality and yourself out of the picture almost, and you're handing yourself over to devote your life to an idea or an ideology, and that's when things seem to go very bad.
Well, I don't know if you ever heard of it, but there was a children's story in English about a scarecrow who had various heads. And when he was just being a scarecrow, he had a head on which didn't think. But when he had to think about something, he took that head off, and he had another head down on the ground, and he put that on, and then that was his thinking head.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that when people start talking religion, they take their thinking head on and put their scarecrow head on.
Hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, all sort of logic and reason goes out the window. And I really don't understand why, but,
it's
just something that happens.
Absolutely. Well, it's an interesting question. I remember an article just a few days ago that even actually described the human brain as being hardwired to have a belief in God, which is pretty interesting that it's actually on some level...
I'm afraid that my brain has been de-hardwired.
There you go. Well, exactly. And I think it's more maybe prone to an idea of a spiritual life as well. I mean, one shouldn't, I believe, confuse spirituality with religion. Those two things are differently. So, but
yeah.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more then about And I know that you must be tired of this, but the Da Vinci Code, I'm tired of it too. And in one way, I hate to kind of return to it. But again, many people have consumed this information as it is now. It's in the psyche of both the patricians and people. What's your take on it? Is it true? Is it false? Is there some kind of, you know, truth elements within the story?
It's fiction.
It's fiction.
Very simple. It's fiction.
Yeah.
It is based... immaterial of what Dan Brown may have said, it's based upon a book by Michael Bagent et al. Called Holy Blood and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Now, I know Michael Bagent, and I knew Richard Lee before he died, and I vaguely knew Henry Lincoln.
Mm.
I think that the problem is that they were sold a pig in a poke, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are academics. They're all basically journalists. Now, therefore, to them, providing that there was some sort of documentary evidence there, they were happy to go along with it because it was a good story.
Okay.
I don't mean I chided Michael with this many a time. The problem is that I actually showed Michael one of the documents I had. I think he actually said so in one of his books.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But they are not, any of them, able to look at it from an academic point of view and say, okay, where did this document come from? You know, the fact it was with the deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
When was it deposited there? 1950. Well, that isn't very old, is it?
It's very late, yeah.
No. Who deposited it? Some guy called Henri Libano. Well, so what?
Mm-hmm.
Who's he? You know, what is his, what's his academic qualifications? None.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where did he get these from? Well, he made them up. So,
okay. Mm-hmm.
This whole thing, I mean, don't ask me what the point of it was. I've got no idea. I really have. This is the one thing I, this whole business of this Priory of Sion and all the rest of it, I cannot fathom what the point of it was. Because it's simply a load of nonsense. There must have been something, I think, I mean, I'm not quite sure, but I think there was this guy, Jean Plantard or something.
Pierre Plantard.
Who I think was trying to prove that he was related to the Royal House of France.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was what the whole thing was about, but I really do not know.
Mm, okay. Well, it's an interesting point.
Well, I mean, there's this guy, for example, who calls himself Prince Michael of Albany. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, yeah. We talked briefly with Lawrence Gardner about that when he was
on.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, you know, it simply isn't true. His documents don't stack up because when he was called before the Lyon Court, he refused to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
And because his documents don't stack up, because Lawrence Gardner, again, I'm sorry, Lawrence Gardner is not an academic. No, he's not.
Mm.
And you cannot go along and say, well, I'm this, that, or the other, when you're not. I mean, you can do it. I mean, you know, there's this guy, Perkin Warbeck, who claimed to be King of England, but he got beheaded, didn't he?
Hmm. Okay, yeah, but there is, one doesn't have to be an academic, I guess, to have a bit of the story, if you know what I mean. But you're saying that the documentation for it doesn't hold up, is that, that's what you're
exactly.
saying?
Exactly. Mm,
okay. Well, there's, again, as I said, when we began talking about this regarding bloodlines and things like that, that there's so many conflicting ideas and theories out there, and again, it's very interesting just listening to what is going on, and that's why also I'm very interested in the roots and the reasons.
Well, I mean, the short answer is, if you have a look at all of my books, you will find the sources for every single thing I say.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Now, for all of the genealogies that I have produced, there are at least two separate sources for each bit of it. Okay?
Right.
With those where I've actually said, I'm sorry, there is only this one source, I have been unable to find another one. But I've said that.
Mm.
That is the difference. You start off with documentation, you see what that documentation says, and you build up from there. You don't start with a theory and then trying to make the documentation fit it. It doesn't work that way.
Right, right. And I know what you mean. But yet again, then, even a document, as you alluded to before, when you talked about that this ended up in the late 1950s in Paris, you know, a faked document. How do you, you know, it's very difficult as well.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, you're perfectly right. You know,
yes.
A document, in order for a document to be validated, if that's the right word, you've got to know what its provenance is. For example, we know, if you take the Abdias manuscript, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Norris Collection in the United States. We know where it came from. We know that it is, if you like, a printed example from 14, whatever it was, of an actual written manuscript which was in the possession of the Habsburg emperors in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We know that. We can show the provenance. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So we know that it came, that we know when it started, because Eusebius mentions it, and he mentions the translation having been made before 250 AD and so on.
Mm.
So we've got a complete trail of the documentation.
Mm.
Are you with me?
Yes.
So that's what you have to have. The same thing is, for example, you've got some of the earliest parts of the Visigothic genealogy that I put in. They come from the Orations of Themestius, from the Vita Sancta Saba, from the Chronicles of Chronicles of Fredegar, from the Annals of Fulda. These are all well-known documents. We know where they are, you know, what their provenance is, and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were written at or more or less at the same time as the events that took place.
See what you mean.
So that is the other thing. That for a document to be, particularly things like genealogies and events happening, you have to have something that was written within 50 years, roughly, of the event happening.
Mm.
Because after that, you know, memory starts going.
Right.
Unless, of course, you know, one or two occasions, like, for example, Dude of St. Quentin, it says, you know, this was given to me by so-and-so and so-and-so, who is, you know, the brother of the king or the brother of the duke or whoever it happens to be. Okay, fine. He's writing down specifically what someone else has told him.
Mm.
But that person knows the answer, but was probably illiterate, so he got someone else to write it down for him.
Mm. Okay.
But, you know, that's fair dues.
Right, right.
But this is what one must look for all the time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I totally agree. It's all about sources and, of course, backing those up and to corroborate the sources, obviously, and so forth. But it's a good point you're making, because this just shows how muddy the water seems to be when it comes to this type of research and how you find your way through this, so to speak.
Appalling.
So yes.
I mean, if you read something like Wikipedia, I sort of cringe and go, ooh, you know. And yet there are people, and I've seen them, who will go around and they will quote their sources as Wikipedia.
Sure, sure.
Well, I'm sorry, you know.
We're saying,
balderdash.
But there's, you know, again, there's it's a huge, one of the world's largest encyclopedias, so it must be, you know, I definitely get your point. I mean, it's just because it's on there, it doesn't make it true, but it doesn't make it false either. You know, it's issue by issue basis, post by post.
I use it myself.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
I will go and I'll say, okay, it says that. What's the source?
Yeah.
Okay. Second. Go to the source and find out what the source says.
Absolutely.
That's what you have to do.
Absolutely. I totally agree. If we return, talk about a little bit of the Da Vinci issue here again. The Sinclairs, the importance of the Sinclairs. There's something that is mentioned. You were referring yourself previously to some of the work that Hugh Sinclair were doing. Important yep. family, not, you know, is this any truth to this? What's your take on it?
The Sinclairs became an important family in Scotland. Where the name Sinclair actually comes from, I think, is in some dispute. There's various suggestions that it came, they took the name from Sinclair sur Epte, and that they were related to Rollo, or descendants from Rollo. I am not sure that that is the answer. But I do think, because I have found a Lord Sinclair and I forget now what his other name, he had two titles,
mm-hmm.
Did marry into the family of the Duke of Normandy.
Okay.
So by 1100, they were certainly, if you like, part of that group of families who were all intermarrying. But I simply don't know the answer to that. I mean, the story that's in the Da Vinci Code about the Saunier and Sinclair, etc., is fiction.
Mm.
You know? Mm. But as regards the rest of it, I simply don't know is the answer.
Yeah.
I haven't really done enough work on it to make a decision one way or another. That they are an Orvunga family is almost certainly correct.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the DNA evidence that's coming out makes that very clear. But apart from that, I don't know where they fit into the picture.
Okay, I see. But was it Hugh Sinclair that himself were doing a lot of...
Dr. Hugh Sinclair. He did a lot of work on the genealogy of the Sinclairs.
Mm-hmm.
And he... what we actually have is some scribbled notes of his, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which another Sinclair actually scanned into a thing and put on the internet. And I rang him and said, you know, is this okay? He said, yes, you know, these are the actual notes, the scribbled notes that Hugh made. I said, okay, fine.
Mm.
But that's what they are. Now, what documents he based those scribbled notes on, unfortunately, we don't know. I suspect that he got hold of copies of the same documents that I've got.
Mm-hmm.
But that he came to slightly different conclusions. But then he was looking at it from the point of view of a Sinclair lineage rather than what I was looking at, which was simply an Orvunga dynasty.
Yeah, the bigger picture, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's interesting. And again, I know, weren't you in contact also a little bit with William F. Mann as another one we had on the show a while back?
Yes, William, well, I mean, I've been in contact with him by email.
Mm-hmm.
I've never met the guy.
All right.
But certainly, he is one of the people who is running this Sinclair DNA project.
Yes.
And certainly, it would appear from the DNA that they are doing that the documentary evidence I have produced is backed up by the DNA evidence that they have.
Mm, okay. That's interesting.
But as I said, I mean, I do not understand DNA, and therefore I have to go along with what someone tells me.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't pretend to understand it because it's, I'm afraid that's not one of the mind around.
No, it's a completely different area, and again, as you said, there seems to be a lot of these different projects around to find either descendants or even to find specific, you know, origins and even placements on the world. So it's a huge, and again, this is a topic or an area of research that really have just opened up, as it were, and we try the best we can, I guess, to try to tie this back. There's the genealogical project and whatever, you know, so there's awful lot of this around.
Yeah, I think the other thing that one must be careful of about DNA is that there are commercial firms who are running ahead of the academic world on this.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I think I'm right in saying this, but don't hold me to it, that the maximum number of markers is about 19, which is accepted by, if you like, King's College London, for example,
mm-hmm.
one of the main centres for this.
Mm-hmm.
While as some of the commercial firms are talking about 52 markers. Well, I mean, I've got no idea if this is valid or not. I simply don't know.
Okay, yeah. So it could be a way to, yeah, get maybe lure people into this area and tell them stuff that might not.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't say that.
Okay, yeah, I'll read between the lines, and it remains unsaid. No worries. Okay.
I'm merely saying that commerce is running ahead of academia.
Yes.
Mind you, sometimes it does. I mean, you know, if you think about it, Microsoft ran ahead of academia for years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But they were right.
And well, exactly. And that was my point previously when I stated that academia, just because you're not in that environment, doesn't mean that you don't have a valid idea or a valid theory or something going. So, yeah, absolutely.
I suppose the main difference is that in academia, you tend to be peer-reviewed.
Mm, yeah.
While as in non-academic circles, you're probably not.
See what you mean? Yeah, yeah.
And that acts as a, well, I don't know, I suppose a certain policing of things to an extent.
Yeah, well...
It's something actually that is by no means agreed by everybody.
Well, exactly, and that's where it's kind of free for all also to begin criticize work and research and, you know, on that level. So it's good that it's being done. I mean, again, it's nothing negative at all. It certainly must stand up to criticism in order for it to be, you know, validated or, you know, so that's very good.
I mean, I'll be perfectly frank. One of my first books, or in fact, my first book was slaughtered by a Cambridge don.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
And because he said it couldn't possibly be right. But then you look at the guy and you say, well, what's he done?
Mm.
And the answer is, of course, he's a librarian in a particular college who's published a few things in academic journals. But guess what? He is a fervent Catholic and a member of Opus Dei.
Mm, there you go. Okay.
So you think, oh, okay.
Yes, yes.
Even sort of when you're talking about sort of academic criticism, one wants to look at the academic and say, well, does he have an axe to grind?
Right, well, exactly. And that's in one degree a little bit, you know, guilty by association, so to speak. I mean, for instance, if we have a Knights Templar involved in this type of research, that would make him biased. Do you think that that's correct to say something like that?
Sorry?
Would you say that that's correct to say that's for instance, one is guilty, if you know what I mean, by association, if one is, for instance, involved in the Knights Templar and doing genealogical research for the descendants of Jesus, that there is a biased or another background here, so to speak, the person we're talking about have an axe to grind in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, my question in that case would be, have you got a position that you're trying to prove, or are you simply looking at documents and seeing what the documents say?
Mm-hmm.
And are you excluding documents that don't go along with what you want them to say?
Yeah, well, exactly. You're cherry picking the evidence, yeah. As it were. Yeah.
And you know, and this is the danger. And I mean, I try desperately not to do that, but I don't know. Maybe there are other documents there that I don't know about because I haven't looked for them.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where there again, the criticism is good because it helps to bring new research and other new areas to light.
Absolutely.
And where people can refine it. So that's very good. Maybe we can spend the last few minutes here just talk a little bit about something that you wrote about in your latest book, and that has to do with the dynasty of the Black Madonna. I don't know if there's much to this or if this is a huge area, but maybe you can just tell us a little bit about this. I was just intrigued by the general idea, or when I spotted it, so to speak, in your book.
Okay. I said to you that, in my opinion, Mary Magdalene was the daughter of John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there is a tradition in Eastern Europe, particularly amongst some of the icons, of a black John the Baptist. Secondly, the idea of Ethiopian, and I say Ethiopian as opposed to Ethiopian,
yes,
because it simply means in Greek the land of the burnt-faced people.
Yes, yes.
And they wouldn't have just called, should we say, Sudanese or Ethiopians that. They would have equally called people of the Arabian Peninsula that, because they were dark-skinned, basically. They, you know, they weren't Caucasian. They were Semitic.
Yes.
And the point that I was trying to make was that Mary Magdalene was very dark-skinned, as were all the Nabataeans, Petrans, etc.
Mm-hmm.
At least the main sort of top people there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being the case, this whole idea of the devotion to the Black Madonna, and if you like, a lineage which sometimes throws up some rather dark-skinned people, may well descend from the marriage of Mary Magdalene and Jesus.
Mm.
But Jesus himself wasn't white, for goodness sake, anyway.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
He was a Semite.
Mm.
So, you know, he was dark-skinned probably by our standards, but I suspect that Mary Magdalene was particularly dark.
Mm. And this is what we can see replicated in many cathedrals today, then, the veneration of this, or the verification, I guess, of this.
Well, that's the point. I mean, people have written books about the Black Madonnas.
Yes.
And everyone's, you know, the church is trying to pretend that this is a sort of black version of the Virgin Mary. Well, I have my doubts. I would say that it's much more likely that Mary Magdalene finished up, or certainly went to southern France at some stage or other, because there are a lot of documentation which shows that. And therefore, she would have possibly stood out there. And if she had a child or children, she would, and if she was related to this mythical figure, Jesus, in some way, shape, or form, then she would have become perhaps an object of worship as, in her own right, as a Black Madonna.
Yes.
That's my theory.
Okay, very, very interesting. You mentioned Ethiopia as well. I've always considered this to be a pretty interesting country. Is there any hints, a lot of clues are leading here? There are people tracking even the Ark of the Covenant there. There's a lot of interesting churches down there and things like that.
oh, dear. yes, I am aware that there are books that have been written about this. The short answer is I don't know. But certainly that Ethiopia, in other words, the geographical area, was at one stage part of the Sabbatean, oblique Nabatean Empire,
and
it was up right up until the 5th century AD.
Right.
And I would suggest that they were probably converted to Judaism, because they certainly were Jews before they became Christians, or a lot of them were, anyway. That they were probably converted to Judaism about that sort of time, because, of course, the Nabataeans, Sabbateans were converted to Judaism by John Hyrcanus of Israel. And I would think, therefore, that this gradually filtered out through this empire that the Nabataean Sabbateans had. And this is probably where they got the idea, because if we can imagine a queen, perhaps, going out to that area, and Sheba, or Sabah, which was the sort of the southern capital of these people, and she became known as the Queen of Sheba, and then they linked this in with the biblical thing, and that's probably why they say that, you know, they were descended from the Queen of Sheba.
And the
I mean, it's just, you know, that's purely speculative.
Right. Do you think there could be a symbolic connection with the King of Solomon then, as his wife, Queen Sheba, yada yada?
Yes, I think this is it, isn't it?
Yes.
Some stage or other, I shall have to have a look at that in detail, but I haven't had the time yet.
Yes, it's a huge story. Many people are already looking at it and so forth. But we can maybe finish off then on as a last note and just quickly on Solomon and even maybe the Temple of Solomon. Again, many people tracking this back to this region. We have remnants potentially left of the Temple of Solomon. Is that anything interesting that you've been looking at, and again, why the importance? What the importance, as you said, might be?
Okay, archaeologically speaking, the so-called first temple of Solomon, so far as I am aware, never existed. In other words, King Solomon and King David did not build this magnificent temple. Almost certainly, it is taken from a temple which was in Phrygia, and which, when they went into exile in Babylon, the scribes would have read, described to them in various diplomatic letters and so on that they had. And I suspect that when they were eventually released back to Israel, they created this mystique of this original temple which had been pulled down, blah, 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 and they then built a second one. But I actually think that second temple was the first one.
Okay, that's interesting. And there's a lot of research going on in regards to even the architecture of the place and the symbolic references. We don't have to go into all of that now, but again, as you said before, Hugh, it's a great great story behind this as well, and a really interesting line of research that one can follow when one goes into it. So anyway,
unfortunately, you know, there's a limited amount of time I have.
Well, exactly, that's why there's so many people around doing this kind of research. But anyway, I think that you bring a lot of interesting points, Hugh, here to the table, so to speak, and I really enjoyed having you on our program here today and to talk about your work, your theories, your research, and so forth. And I want to round things off here, this second segment, with you simply telling us again the titles of your book and where people can go to find out more about them.
Okay. Well, the titles of the books are The God Kings of Europe, The God Kings of England, and The God Kings of Outremer. You can get them from Amazon, or hopefully from any good bookshop. There's a blog spot called http://humantgumray.blogspot.com, which gives you all information as the ISBN numbers, etc., and a little bit about what each of them says. So hopefully that people will go out and buy my books and become more interested in what I've said.
Absolutely. Again, the website is hughmontgomery.blogspot.com. Again, we'll have this linked up on Red Ice Creations. And we'd love to have you back at some point, Hugh. I'm still waiting for the God Kings of Europe, and I definitely want to go through a little bit more information in that, and maybe we can do a second program here if you're up for it.
I'd love to, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you again, Hugh. Take good care, and we'll talk more soon.
Jolly good.
That's our program with Hugh Montgomery. Thank you for spending some of your time with us. Red Ice Radio will return on Sunday. We have upcoming on the program Todd Campbell from Through the Looking Glass, Ian Crane on the Alternative View Conference at the end of May in London Heathrow that we'll be attending. We're from Red Ice. We also have Ben Singleton from Pseudo Occult Media coming on the program. So good stuff ahead as we're gearing up for more live webcasts. We have a series upcoming with Michael Tesserion on the Brotherhood of Death. More information about this will be available on redicecreations.com as details unfold. And to all of you out there who are making your own music, we're interested in playing it on Red Ice Radio. Go to our radio archive, click on Bumper Music at the top and read more about the details and how to send us your music. Thank you for joining us. Take good care of yourself, and we'll talk more later. Bye-bye.